Hello, I'm Luke Broadwater, State House reporter for the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Aaliyah Cromer, pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the policy, people, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to talk to Senator Sarah Elfrith from District 30 in Anne Arundel County and Delegate Julian Ivey from District 47 in Prince George's County. They're both Democrats, and they're also the youngest members of their respective legislative chambers. We are coming to you from the Sun's State House Bureau this week. We're not in the posh digs of the recording studio in Baltimore, so if you hear a lot of printing going on in the background, that's because the Sun's State House Bureau is located directly next to the printing press down here, so you will definitely hear that from time to time during the podcast.
All right. So first, we're going to take a look back at the Baltimore Sun reporting from this past week. We're 2 weeks from sine die and about a week into Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh's Healthy Holly troubles. Where do you want to start?
Well, this has been a unfolding situation very quickly. I believe last time we came to you last week, the mayor had just stepped down from the University of Maryland Medical System Board of Directors after we reported in the Sun that she had she and several others had been doing contracting with the medical system that they were supposed to oversee. Since then, a lot more has happened. The mayor has agreed to return $100,000 to the system. Two other board members have resigned. The CEO of the system has taken a leave of absence after a very heated meeting with the governor and the Senate president. Four more board members have taken leaves of absence. And just this morning, my colleagues reported that tens of thousands of the books are unaccounted for. We know 8,700 of them are sitting in a warehouse owned by the school system, but so far, both the University of Maryland Medical System and the mayor have failed to produce any receipts or documentation to show that other books were printed and distributed to kids as ordered. So we're going to stay on top of this story, folks. It's a very important story, not just involving the mayor, but involving some of the most powerful people who are overseeing how healthcare and medicine is delivered throughout the state. And there's emergency legislation right now in Annapolis that is advancing. There was a bill hearing about this on Friday, and it now appears that this this emergency legislation that would ban no-bid contracting by board members is very likely to pass.
As you all know, we suspended the rules in the House yesterday to introduce this emergency bill and send it directly to committee. Given some of the revelations that have come out over the past week of the University of Maryland Medical System, I'm sure many of you were surprised by the news stories, as was the speaker, who's been a longtime board member at the University of Maryland Medical System.
To everyone who's learned about the scandal, it's shocking. And it seems to me, having served on nonprofit boards, that someone had to look the other way. What I want to know is who looked the other way.
So again, we're going to stay on top of this and bring you the latest at BaltimoreSun.com.
But amidst all of this, the beat does go on. And Mayor Pugh last week, along with three other previous Baltimore City mayors, made a trip down to Annapolis to testify against a bill that would help accelerate plans to turn Laurel Park into a super track capable of hosting major races. This is clearly seen as the exit plan for Pimlico to no longer host the Preakness. What is your reporting at the Baltimore Sun found?
Yes, for this one, let's bring in my colleague Pamela Wood from the State House Bureau. Hey, Pam.
Hi, Luke.
And last week, you were in attendance at a meeting with the Legislative Black Caucus, and four Baltimore mayors came down to Annapolis to testify. What did they have to say?
Yes, we had four mayors came down to Annapolis to present to the Black Caucus. It was the current mayor, Catherine Pugh, as well as former mayors Martin O'Malley, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, and Kurt Schmoke. And they were trying to get the Legislative Black Caucus on board with the city's position and the city's efforts to basically save Pimlico Racetrack and keep the Preakness Stakes in Baltimore.
This is a big threat to our city. This is the second jewel of the Triple Crown. This, you don't hear Louisville talking about moving the Kentucky Derby. You don't hear about the Belmont moving the third part of the Triple Crown. Those who own racetracks invest in those communities because they believe in the neighborhood and the community. We don't believe that this family understands the impact that it would have on Baltimore.
And how was their message received?
Yeah, so their message was basically they were asking the Black Caucus to join in efforts to defeat a bill that would use state bonds to accelerate renovations at Laurel Park. Of course, the city sees this as possibly spelling the demise of Pimlico. So some Black Caucus members, particularly, of course, those in Baltimore City, were 100% on board with this idea. Some Black Caucus members from other parts of the state were asking questions, kind of seeking more information about the role of the racetrack and the Preakness itself in the neighborhood, what might happen to the neighborhood if the racetrack were shut down. So they were kind of searching for a little more information to decide if they would support it. And so far, we haven't seen any action yet from the Black Caucus.
And this isn't the only thing Baltimore is doing to try to keep the Preakness in Baltimore. What else? There's a lawsuit, right?
That's right. Mayor Pugh filed a lawsuit in Baltimore City Circuit Court. It asks a few different things. One is to ask a judge to block any potential move of the Preakness out of Baltimore. It also seeks to block the use of the state bonds for Laurel, even though this bill hasn't passed yet. The lawsuit wants to stop that. And actually, Senate President Mike Miller indicated to reporters that now that there's this lawsuit out there referencing this legislation, it makes it difficult to move that legislation forward. So that may effectively help stall that bill that the mayor is seeking.
And then there's also this effort among the city senators to have the Laurel Supertrack bill amended. Tell us what their amendment would do and how that's being received in the Senate Budget and Tax Committee.
In a way, this is sort of a plan B, that if this bill for the state bonds for Laurel goes forward, the city senators want to make sure that the Park Heights and Pimlico neighborhoods aren't left behind and forgotten about. There's a big worry that if Pimlico were to shut down, there would be just a big hole in the neighborhood. So this amendment to the Laurel bill would require the Strona group that owns the tracks to put forth a development, a redevelopment proposal for the Pimlico property. Basically, what amounts to a plan B for Pimlico. Senator Nancy King, the chairwoman of the Senate Budget and Taxation Committee, said that she's considering this and she really wants to work out a compromise here if that bill is going to go forward.
And then let's switch topics briefly to medically assisted suicide. What's happening with this legislation?
That bill is finally moving forward in the Senate. As we reported a few weeks back, it was approved by the House of Delegates after a really emotional and intense debate. And it's now moving forward in the state Senate this week. This is the bill that would allow certain Marylanders who have terminal illnesses with a prognosis of less than 6 months to live to request and obtain medication that they could take to end their lives. And it's been somewhat controversial and quite a lot of attention here. And it is moving forward in a slightly different form in the state Senate.
And this bill was heavily amended in a way the advocates do not like. Pam, tell us what was added into the bill and why it's so distasteful to the advocates.
The Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee spent 7 hours discussing dozens of amendments to this bill, and some of the key ones that they added included changing the minimum age for eligibility from 18 up to 21. They also added a requirement for a mental health screening for patients before they could get the medication. And they removed part of the initial bill as passed by the House that would have made it difficult to sue a doctor in a civil lawsuit for providing this medication to a patient. Now, the advocates who've been pushing for this bill say this adds so many more roadblocks that they believe it may be difficult for any terminally ill patient to actually take advantage of this and participate in the program. And they do not support the bill in its current form, and they are hoping to get changes made before it's finally passed.
And we're going to stay on top of this, folks, all week. This is going to be one of the hot bills we're tracking in Annapolis. Pamela Wood from the Sun State House Bureau, thanks so much.
Thank you, Luke.
Okay, finally, the Maryland General Assembly has one core job: to pass the state's budget for the fiscal year. They have a hard and fast approaching deadline of April 1st. Where are we at on the budget, Luke?
Well, right now, and hopefully, this is unfolding as we speak. The Senate and the House are in a conference committee ironing out their differences between their two competing versions of the budget. The main difference is about $100 million for the Kerwin Commission recommendations to fund those to fund that increased funding for public schools. The House put in $100 million more than the Senate. The Senate says, let's go slow. We need to pass revenues before we can ramp up funding. The proposal out of the Senate is to do a tax on out-of-state third-party online sellers, so your eBays and your Amazons, and they believe they can come up with $95 million a year from that, and that would be how they would get that that money for Kerwin. So that's the Senate's position. We'll see how that's ironed out in committee. The other thing that a lot of people are watching is the Boost program. This isn't a ton of money, but it is a little bit of an ideological fight, and that has to do with money that the governor wants in the budget for poor kids from private poor kids to go to private schools, kids that are in his view failing schools and failing districts, and to let them go to private schools where he thinks they can get a better education. The House cut that money in the budget, and they want to phase out that program. They think you should support public schools, not private schools, with state taxpayer dollars. And the Senate had put the money back in, so we'll see how that works out as well. There are, of course, a bunch of other differences as well, but those are two of the main ones we're watching, and they both have to do with education funding.
Okay. All right. And with that, let's welcome our guests, Senator Sarah Elfrith and Delegate Julian Ivey. Welcome to Roughly Speaking.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
So before we get to know you a little better, I'd like to get to know your districts. Starting with you, Senator, can you give us the need to know about the 30th in about 30 seconds?
Sure. Well, I represent the city of Annapolis, some of the suburbs, and then all of South County. Folks might have seen my district in the news this weekend. We burned our socks in celebration of the spring and ate some wonderful local oysters. So it's a pretty unique and interesting and beautiful district that I'm proud to represent.
All right, Delegate, your turn. Tell me about the 47th.
Yes. So the 47th, it shares a boundary with D.C. and also with Montgomery County. That's a lovely little district, one of the smaller geographically. We have the city of Kentland and Bladensburg, Cheverly, and several other municipalities.
Okay. So one of my favorite things about part-time legislatures is that the legislators have diverse occupations and identities outside of being a politician. So, Delegate Ivey, you played Simba in The Lion King on Broadway. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about this experience, and how did you escape all the trappings of child stardom?
Well, being in The Lion King, it gave me the confidence to run for office, to be a vocal leader on campus at the University of Maryland, and also to remember to roar every once in a while here in Annapolis.
Wonderful. So, Senator, at 30 years old, right? Is mm-hmm. that right? Does it feel like your time at Towson University was a lifetime or a minute ago?
A little bit of both, definitely, but the opportunities I had at Towson definitely prepared me to be in the Senate, absolutely.
So let's talk about those, your experiences at Towson University. You were heavily involved with student government, mm-hmm. and while there are a lot of differences, at least I hope so, between serving in student government and the Maryland General Assembly, what are some of the similarities, and then I want to highlight one of the differences I'd like you to talk about.
Okay. Some of the similarities, I mean, it's all about our success here, as in anywhere, is getting along with other people, building strong relationships, having a strong sense of values, and then just working with other people to make sure those values are shared.
Okay. So the biggest difference I see between the Maryland General Assembly and your service in state government, and your service at the Towson University student government, is that you are all the same age at mm-hmm. Towson University. But here, you're not. Both of you are significantly younger than everybody else. Can you both highlight some maybe perhaps generational differences you see between you, millennials, and perhaps your baby boomer colleagues?
Well, there are so many similarities, quite frankly. We want to all make sure that we're representing our districts accordingly, that we're bringing resources back to our home districts. But, of course, you know, one thing that the Democratic Caucus has been doing this year is having a contest regarding Twitter followers. And it's great to see individuals who never had a Twitter handle create it and win these contests, because you know they just had more people follow them in the beginning. But really, it's just been a wonderful experience seeing how much we all have in common, regardless of our age differences.
Who is winning the Twitter competition, if I might butt in?
I don't actually remember who won. The contest did end, but it was not a millennial.
Okay. Wow. I did troll Delegate Eric Lukey in that I had more Facebook followers than
right.
he did.
Right.
But I think we have a greater emphasis on communicating what we're doing.
Yeah.
And trying to do it in different ways through social media and increased videos. But I post probably 3 or 4 times a day, only when I have something to say. But I think it's something in 2019. It's wonderful that we're doing the work we're doing, but it's equally important that we're communicating it in a way our constituents understand and can respond to and feel a part of.
So we're on the home stretch of legislative session, and while both of you have not, while both of you have been in and around politics through most of your adult lives, perhaps Delegate Ivy, you've never not been around politics.
When I was 6,
yeah,
I was introduced to this. Yeah.
But how is it different now, actually being the person, so actually serving an elected office? Like, I know that you've all done things with the party organization and certainly volunteered. How is it different being, you know, the person, the elected?
Yeah, I worked as the government affairs director for the National Aquarium, so I spoke for the fish as their lobbyist for a number of years down here. But it's very different being on the opposite side of the table now and as elected official. You know, the days aren't any longer or shorter, but I think we have to be on quite a bit. I say that I live my life in 15-minute increments, and you have to kind of pivot between a meeting on transportation to education to public health to the arts and then back to, you know, the budget in a pretty short amount of time. So it's kind of mental gymnastics, but I love it.
Yeah, the mental gymnastics, that's a brilliant way of putting it. For me, just growing up watching politics, From the high chair is what I would say, what I would call it. You know, I've learned a lot about how this town works, how politics in general works, and, you know, it's not very different. It hasn't changed too much. And so with that being said, the senator mentioned it earlier, it's all about relationship building and making sure individuals know your values and staying true to those values. So for me, I was on the Cheverly Town Council prior to running for delegate, and I was the 21-year-old youngest council person in the history of the town. And even in Cheverly, it was about building consensus, building a team, and showing everyone your values and finding if there were any common values amongst the group.
Is there anything specific that you've learned that you didn't know around 80 days ago or so? So looking back at the very beginning, what's one specific thing that you just didn't see coming?
Geez, I mean, where do we start, really? you know, it's like drinking water from a fire hydrant.
Yeah.
And you know, you're made to be an expert in a very small window of time on so many different issues. But the one thing that I definitely took away was, and I'm sorry to be the broken record, but building consensus. Yeah, finding people who have common values and working to bring all of those individuals together. I mean, there are even individuals across the aisle. It's not as there isn't the gridlock that you see in Washington here in Annapolis. And you can find individuals with common values even across the aisle. It's about working with them as well.
Senator?
Absolutely. I think you're as effective as you want to be, like in any other thing in life. And so if you put in the time and you build those relationships, and I reached across the aisle on one bill in particular, my oyster bill, and worked with Republican senators more than Democratic senators, frankly. And at the end of the day, we had a 45-2 vote. And the two senators who voted against it stood up and said if they could, they would have voted for it, but if their districts wouldn't allow it. But I think that was the lesson I learned, that it's sometimes as simple as reaching out your hand and asking for help or asking for a meeting to build consensus on a bill, and it's all about what you make of it.
Wonderful. All right, so the fun's over, and now you have to talk to Luke.
We love Luke.
Yeah. just wanted to speak briefly about some policy items. What do you think is your biggest achievement this session so far, and what's your biggest disappointment?
I'd say my biggest achievement was that oyster bill. It kind of started off as a small idea. I heard about it in my community. We had a community meeting with some advocates from Deal, which is the southernmost part of my district, and they mentioned this idea of a consensus-built fisheries management plan for oysters that they did on the chop tank. And so I called the scientists at UMSEAS the next day and said, can we do this just in Herring Bay in a little creek in my district? And they said, no, we think we could do it for the whole bay. So I called the speaker's office the next day, and we got the ball rolling, and we're able to completely revolutionize the way that we do fisheries management planning for the most controversial of topics here in Maryland, the oyster. So I feel very strongly that is the best path forward. It's all about consensus building, like all things in life, and that's how we got the bill passed, was to build consensus. So.
And this bill, makes permanent oyster sanctuaries, is that right?
So there's two oyster bills. The Speaker Bush's bill and Chair Pinsky's bill creates 5 permanent sanctuaries of the 51 sanctuaries. 5 of them will be permanent moratorium from harvesting. My bill and Chairman Kumar Barve's bill in the House creates a new oyster advisory commission made up of 60% watermen, 40% advocates. It brings in professional facilitators from Florida who've done this in the Gulf of Mexico. They did it on the little chop tank here in Maryland. And over the course of 2 years, they do a series of modeling, building consensus. I call it an airing of the grievances for the Seinfeld fans out there, to come together and trust one another and build a fisheries management plan for the whole bay that works for everybody and is built by the people it impacts the most.
And how about disappointment? Is there anything you really wanted to get past this year that ended up in a drawer?
I put in 9 bills, and 8 of them have crossed over to the House.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And 8 of those bills have strong cross files in the House, and the House has already passed the House version. So I feel pretty good about my freshman year.
That's a pretty stellar record for a freshman.
Good batting average. Yeah.
And I'm on the Budget and Tax Committee, so just I've been really focused on learning the behemoth that is the $46.6 billion state budget and trying to get as much funding for our district and for our priorities as possible.
And how about you, Delegate?
Yeah, I would say the biggest success that I had this freshman term here, this freshman session, is passing a bill. I worked with Eric Barron, Delegate Barron, and also Senator Ferguson on this bill. And the bill would make it so that the Register of Wills is now required to waive fees and fines associated with creating a will after death to allow for individuals who've lived in that home with the owner to stay in the home and to make sure that if poverty is the reason why you can't pay for the fees and fines associated, that we waive those fees. So that's a really important one for me and my district. We also got a bond bill through to renovate an old library in my district. It has asbestos issues and a horrible roof, and it's been closed for a few years now. So to be able to get that through was very important for me and my district. One thing that has really been, a disappointment, just plain and clear. We see what's happening in New Zealand after the horrible massacre, and we see how quickly they moved on banning semi-automatic weapons. And I put forward a bill which would eliminate the loophole that allows for one last AR-15 to be sold in the state, and it hasn't moved yet. So I hope that we can get some movement on that. I don't want us to have to wait for a shooting to happen in a school with this weapon for us to move on this. I don't want a newspaper to have a shooting with this specific weapon for us to move on this. I think we can move on it without having blood be shed. So I hope that we can get on that quickly.
If I could jump on that, I represent the district, obviously, where the Capitol Gazette shooting happened last year, and we put in a bill to create June 28th as Freedom of the Press Day. But it's wonderful that we're celebrating the freedoms that we have, but at the same time, I too wish we were making greater progress on common sense gun safety measures. And there's some really great bills, some of which have moved in one chamber or another, but we have a lot of progress still to make.
And then speaking of the press, you, Senator, had some, now this wasn't a bill, you were involved with an investigation my colleague Catherine Rentz did, where she had some findings about sexual assault waivers and their use by police departments. And you saw that and immediately got some change in Anne Arundel County. Can you walk us through what happened there?
Sure. I have an incredible staff who saw the article and pulled it for me. I was coming from a meeting with the Secretary of DBM, going to a hearing. They handed me the article. I closed the door just reading the headline and said, what the... expletive. I won't say it on air. But went straight to my committee. I texted my county executive and said, can you please give me a call immediately? Within 15 minutes, he called me. He then called the police chief, called me back. We had a little back and forth, and frankly, this was an issue that we were, Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, Harford County police were asking victims of rape and sexual assault to sign waivers, ending, theoretically, their investigations. And to me, that was the only crime that we ever asked victims to waive away their rights. Now, they still had the right to reopen the case, but I think there was a level of wanting to clear cases at a higher rate. There's also a little bit of condescension, you know, kind of patting a woman on the head and saying, there, you don't really want to go through an investigation. So to me, it just was nonsense, and we were able to stop the practice here in Anne Arundel County through the county executive and police chief within an hour.
Wow, that's amazing. and then delegate, I think the first time I typed your name into a news story was this year around the issue with the Tubman and Douglas statues.
Yes, sir.
There was a contract before the Board of Public Works to have these long-desired statues put up in the State House, but it didn't involve any minority contractors.
That's right.
I think a lot of people saw that you showed some leadership as a freshman. Tell us about what happened there and why you just decided to write this letter.
So these two historic figures are being honored, and I think that first and foremost we should definitely talk about that, that we're moving in the right direction, honoring these two Goliaths, quite frankly. But 0% of the contract was awarded to minority-based business, and I had an issue with that. Also, it was a business that was not based in the state of Maryland either. So there are multiple ways that we could talk about this issue. And the reason why, you know, it came to mind and I just felt compelled enough to say something, it's a $600,000 contract. Overall, it's a very small drop of water in the bucket of the $46 billion budget we just approved. But, you know, if we're going to celebrate individuals who've made such a large sacrifice, and we all know what it was that they were fighting in regard to, I think that we should have made sure that we gave an African-American artist the opportunity to have that as something that they've done, because they could then go and build off of that and possibly have future contracts to be awarded in the future. But instead, this contract was awarded to a Virginia-based firm. They did do the George Washington statue that sits in our state house today, and it's a wonderful statue. But nonetheless, I do think that there, and in fact, I know for a fact, there's an individual in my district, lives in Brentwood, who created the Marion Barry statue that stands in D.C. So there's someone who already has the expertise, the credibility to do this work, and we should be focusing on spending our money in Maryland first, and also making sure that we're giving minorities an opportunity to make this positive impact on the state.
And then, Senator, you had, as a former student member of the Board of Regents, you were one of the lead sponsors on the reform bill for the Board of Regents after the scandal involving the football team and the way they were treating players and, sadly, the death of Jordan McNair. Can you talk about that legislation, why you put it in, and how it will help reform things?
Sure. I think one of the biggest lessons for me when I first came down here was really what our role is. And it, oddly enough, is a little bit of a tangent, but oddly enough, we were in a bill hearing about water skiing, and somebody said that you don't have the authority as a General Assembly to dictate what goes on the water. And a Republican House member said, frankly, we gave DNR the authority and we can take it away. And that's kind of when it hit me that is our role. We're here on behalf of our communities, on behalf of the people. And the Board of Regents is really no different. We gave them the authority to govern higher education in 1988. I like to joke that the board is older than I am. And we really have never touched that code in the last 31 years. Senator Jim Rosebep and I are the only two members of the General Assembly who have served on the Board of Regents, so it was pretty essential that he and I and Delegate Ben Barnes, who represents College Park, were the ones who put this in. We worked very closely. We worked with the university system. We worked with the governor's office. To me, it's a healthy review of how the board operates, and it puts a lot of greater transparency, requiring them to live stream their meetings, to take public comment, which has never been a thing before, believe it or not, to publish their minutes. And it also requires a little bit more oversight, that the Senate will have to confirm twice the chair of the Board of Regents. So when the board self-selects a chair, that chair then needs to come back and be re-vetted through the Senate. It has about 17 other components to the bill, but to me it was just a healthy review of the authority we've given an organization that's frankly one of the biggest in the state. It's a $1 billion organization, and we need to have trust, and the public needs to rebuild the trust we have in the board, and I think this bill is a step in the right direction.
And then you both won elections where you ousted older, more established candidates. Delegate, let's start with you. And you even had a little internal issue with Ben Jealous writing a letter. Did he ask you to drop out, or what happened there? Can you talk about that race and how you were able to win?
Ben Jealous is a tremendous mentor of mine, a very good friend of mine. I think he would have made a wonderful governor. So many policies that we agree on. We're both very strong progressives. So I look forward to what the future brings for Ben, and I look forward to sitting down with him after session.
And how about taking on an incumbent? What kind of challenges was that for you?
You know what? I really respect Jimmy Tarlow. I mean, just through and through, a remarkable progressive icon here in Annapolis. Large shoes for me to fill for the 47th, and I've been doing as well as I can. Also to fill my mother's shoes, just two tremendous progressives that came before me. And we still work together. There's a great relationship between the two of us, and also with my mother as well, I'll say that. but it's tough because he and I, we're both delegates to the National Convention for Bernie Sanders. I believe he and I will both be supporting the future president again this election cycle. And so, for me, elections are very important. They have consequences. But once the will of the voters is heard, I think that we should be respectful about that.
And you mentioned your mom. You come from a family with long roots in Maryland politics. Your dad was the state's attorney.
Yeah.
Your mom was lieutenant governor candidate. What kind of influence have they been on you?
You know what? Yesterday, we were sitting down. We were having family dinner, and... it was the day before, and my mom was cooking steaks. She likes them extra rare, and it was just a wonderful moment for us to sit again and talk politics over that same dinner table, and to hear lessons from them. They've been giving us these lessons our whole lives, and it's why I was ready to run at 21, and why I'm as effective as I am here at 23. So, a wonderful relationship that we have, but. Large shoes for me to fill, and every single day I wake up trying to be just an ounce of what they've been so far.
And Senator, you were able to win in a swing district. I mean, this is a district that oftentimes votes for Republicans. Mm-hmm. How'd you pull that off?
I did count. I think I was on the trail officially for something like 498 days, most of which I was knocking doors and raising as much money as possible. So we had most people... compared it to like a mini congressional campaign, I had the privilege of running as a team with Speaker Mike Bush. So between him and the volunteers that came statewide, I mean, we had people come in from Montgomery County, Baltimore City every weekend to help us knock on doors in the general election. We put out 110, 115 volunteers every weekend knocking on doors.
Wow.
So we just had a groundswell of old-fashioned boots-on-the-ground campaign, and people responded really positively to it. And I'm going to go right back to door knocking in April and tell people what I was able to accomplish on behalf of their vote. So.
Wow, I thought I ran a great race.
I mean, it's one of those few districts, right, that the general is actually the general, not the primary.
Yeah.
Not the general.
I did have a primary as well, too.
Sure.
Which was interesting, oddly personal, but it definitely prepared me for a really tight race in the general. I was told all many times that I was too young and unmarried and childless from both sides of the aisle, frankly, and was able to run a successful campaign based on the values of our community. And I think I have a tremendous respect for my my Republican opponent, but I think we just frankly outran them.
And then last question, what have you learned so far that you wish you knew your first day coming in into office? Anything?
Yeah, it's not going to all happen at once. and also to get cross files in the Senate. That's a really important one. The one bill that I did have a cross file for is the one that passed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that the sausage making is pretty ugly and no one wants to watch it. It is ugly because you have to have the creative flexibility to put things on the table and try to work with each other and compromise. And, you know, at the end of the day, if everybody's a little bit angry at you, if everybody wins a little bit, everybody loses a little bit, that's probably the best place for a bill to be when you have stakeholders coming from opposite sides of the table. So I wish things were ideal. I wish everybody walked away happy. Frankly, that's just never going to happen in this world where we're creating major policy shifts for our community. But I think that's it. I thought maybe people would be a little more, maybe a little too idealistic walking into this. But at the end of the day, we were able to get things done that I think benefit everybody.
Senator Sarah Alfrith and Delegate Julian Ivey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, that's all we have for this week's Roughly Speaking Government Edition.
Thanks to everyone for listening, and a special thanks to producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller. As we say each week, while times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't, so please subscribe to the Baltimore Sun. Thank you all, and see you next week. We have just two episodes left.